The remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for March 3rd is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance with the House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed by House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee present.
Lee present. Vice Chair Murphy. Vice Chair Murphy. Representative Erdahl.
Present.
Erdahl present. Representative Igbaje.
Present.
Igbaje present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Berg present. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Frankie.
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg present.
Freiberg present. Representative Hansen. Excuse me. Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Hewitt present. Representative Lilly.
Present.
Lily present. Representative Lucero.
Lucero present.
Lucero present. Representative Moran.
Present.
Moran present. Representative Pearson. Representative Pearson. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Rasmussen present. Representative Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Representative West.
West present.
West present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Zhang present. Vice Chair Murphy. Vice Chair Murphy. And then Representative Pearson. All right, Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. A quorum is present. Representative Ryder, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, March 1st?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ryder moves the minutes for Tuesday, March 1st. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, March 1st are approved. Members, today we will begin with two presentations on lead service lines replacement in Minnesota. As you may recall, thank you, Chair Murphy. As you may recall, the NCSL presented on this piece last month, and we learned about lead service line funding in the federal infrastructure bill. Today, PFA Director Freeman will provide an update on the current lead service line funding in the federal bill. And so with that, we'll go to Director Freeman first and then the Department of Health. Director Freeman, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and members. I'm Jeff Freeman, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. And I presented, as Chair Lee said, some of this information a couple of weeks ago. So I will go quickly and then be happy to take any questions, and I will share my screen with a few slides. If you see those,
Director Freeman, we can see your presentation with the notes, and so if you want to go to slideshow mode.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. I'm sorry. Right now, the only program that can fund lead service line replacement is the PFA's drinking water state revolving fund. And that is the fund that funds all manner of drinking water infrastructure projects. It contains a mix of federal funds, state match, and loan repayments. And the key for this purpose is the federal funding, which can fund the private portion of the lead service line as well as the public, and that's a key thing for funding these projects. Federal law allows a small portion of the annual federal capitalization grants to be provided to projects as principal forgiveness or principal forgiveness grants. So each year when we receive the federal grant in the past to this point, it's been a small percentage of those funds. In 2020, there was a change to PFA statutes to authorize the use of those principal forgiveness funds for replacement of lead service lines, and the amounts were kept fairly small, 50% of project costs up to $250,000. We made our first project award to St. Paul in just last summer, July 21. To date, they've replaced 97 lines with those funds. We have about seven other projects on the current project priority list and expect to receive more. So where we're at now and is the game changer is the Federal Infrastructure Act, Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which as we talked about 2 weeks ago, a total of $668 million through the PFA's state revolving funds for water infrastructure projects. And that breaks down into three categories and includes a large portion, as I highlighted there with the arrow, for lead service line replacements, $43.1 million per year. That money is to be provided. 49% of those funds can be in the form of the principal forgiveness grants, which means 51% is out as a loan. There's no required state match. Projects follow the existing drinking water state revolving fund funding process, which starts with projects submitting proposals to the health department for placement on the project priority list, and then also to PFA for our intended use plan. So where we are right now, we're still waiting for EPA to issue formal guidance. We've had a number of meetings with them, and there's another meeting scheduled for later today. But because the money is going through the state revolving fund process, I think we have a pretty good idea of the basics of how that will work. So it starts with inventories. Many cities do not know how many lead service lines they have or where they are. The level of information varies from city to city. And cities need to get to sort of understand those where they're at with the inventories to then be able to develop projects from that. So the inventories are the upfront work. As cities identify how many lead lines they have and where they are, they can start to develop their strategies for replacing those and how they're going to be able to use these funds. We have had conversations and continue to have conversations with cities and consultants on how the funding will work and the flexibility. Our goal is to provide flexibility in for each city to determine its the best approach for its needs. We are right now accepting project proposals for the 2023 priority list and intended use plan. And of course, this is a five-year funding through the federal infrastructure bill. So if cities aren't ready to submit project proposals this year, then there's always future years to do that as well. Based on the proposals that we receive, and we'll be putting together our intended use plan late summer, early fall, and we hope then to be able to apply for the first year of the EJA funds for lead service lines by this fall and have projects ready to go in 2023. I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and be happy to take questions.
President Erdahl. Representative Erdahl, you're on mute.
All right, I'm here now. Mr. Freeman, is it a correct assumption that virtually all of our pipes under Minnesota town streets are lead?
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl, no, there's a variety of materials, and the health department folks can better describe this, but they are not all lead. There's copper and galvanized and some plastic pipe in some places. So there is a mix, and cities will need to do some work to figure out how many lead lines they have.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Chairman and Mr. Freeman. Well, that's good to know. Now, when the lead pipes are replaced, I assume then are they replaced with another material?
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl. Yes, I believe copper is generally the preferred material, but that's something that the health department can speak to better than I.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Switching topics here, Mr. Freeman, each bonding cycle, we put in the bonding bill money for PFA. And this year, the governor is asking for $200 million. In a normal year, and I know this year we have apparently $668 million to spread over 5 years, how much federal dollars do you get? I know there's a lot of leveraging that happens, but in an average year, what do you get for federal money in addition to the state money?
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl, for 2021, the amount was roughly $29 million for the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is the wastewater projects, and about $16 million for the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. Then there's some various set-asides that come off the top of those funds, so they're not all available for projects. But we expect that the EJA federal funds, which are in addition to those regular capitalization grants, the funding for the supplemental funding for existing programs will exceed the amount that we've been receiving. So it's a significant additional amount.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And then just to sum up, apparently between the state and the federal government, you should be able to do a significant amount of PFA remedying in the next bonding cycle. So hopefully you can keep doing the fine job that you've been doing over the years with this. Thank you.
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good morning, Mr. Freeman. Thank you for coming today. I just have a question. It seems like part of the problem that I keep hearing about is trying to figure out what the scope of the problem, so the inventory. And I know the governor has a $4 million to do this, and it just seems, how can we help there? Do you think that maybe we need to grow that a little bit? It's a mighty big state, and it just seems like we kind of need to know the scope of the magnitude of the situation that we're dealing with, or how we can, best utilize the federal money and where to put it. So I just kind of curious your thoughts on how we can help as a committee.
Director Freeman.
Chair Lee, Representative Lilly, the health department, I think, will be testifying about specifically about what they're under their report on from a couple of years ago, the scope of the lead service line problem, and then also specific actions that are occurring now, along with his part and the governor's recommendation. So I'll let them speak to that.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Freeman. And yeah, it just seems like just making sure that we kind of know where we're at, or, the road we need to drive. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And my question would probably be better after both presentations. I just wanted to be sure that Mr. Freeman would be here for questions at that point.
Yes.
I'll have you there, Representative Ryer. So, Mr. Freeman, we have some discussion on this. So, can you let us know? So, under EJA, less service line, I believe the funding can be used for associated activities directly connected with to the identification, planning, design, and replacement of less service line. And so can you tell us, can we use the federal funding to do the inventory? And if we can, why not?
Chair Lee, so it, I mean, there's, I think the issue is there's sort of different levels of detail here when we talk about inventories. The way, because the federal funding goes through the state revolving fund process, for us to access those funds and award those funds, we have to have cities with specific project proposals on the list. And then when we fund projects when they're ready to start construction, and we can then reimburse cities for prior incurred planning and design costs. And I think the planning costs, certainly as you get into that, the term associated costs, there will be work to sort of take the basic inventory information and determine project scope and determine perhaps more in more detail which specific houses on a street have lead service lines. But the inventory that the health department will be talking about, I think, really is the upfront work before there's specific projects that are scoped and put on the list, the upfront work to research records, building permit records, in some cases actually get into the homes and into the basements to look at the service lines, or in other ways determine the scope of the service line problem within each city. And I think that upfront work is where the governor's recommended funding will be very helpful, which is not something we can do until, as I explained, we've got to have a project on the list before we can start providing funding.
So, Director Freeman, are we prohibited from EJA or other federal laws to appropriate a specific amount from the $43 million that we're going to get from the fiscal year to do this inventory work that you were just talking about?
Surely, no. I mean, there's nothing that would prohibit the state from providing additional funds for any of this.
Specifically from the $43 million from this fund?
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Lee, the $43 million is governed by the federal EPA state revolving fund regulations, and that's the guidance document that I mentioned. I'll have more detail on the EJA funds, but that's where the constraints on exactly how that funding can be spent and how, first of all, what needs to be done before we can access the funds, that's where there would be the, it would not allow doing sort of upfront funding for the inventory work without having projects on the list.
And Director Freeman, I think you spoke a little bit about this a little at the beginning of your remarks. Do we have a timeline of when the EPA is going to provide their guidance on this specific fund?
Chair Lee, well, I'm hopeful we will start to see that yet even this afternoon, and I assume that probably won't be the final word. There'll be additional information that comes, but EPA knows that states are very anxious to get that guidance so we can access the funds and get these projects rolling, so I know they're working on it. As I mentioned, we're not waiting for the guidance. We are right now encouraging cities to apply for the project priority list to the extent they, some cities already have a good idea. They've done some inventory work and they know where they want it, how they want to focus projects. And we're encouraging them to get on the list now so that we can apply for those funds as soon as possible.
Thank you, Director Freeman. And maybe this is for the Department of Health as they come up. I think it'll be good to provide the committee an understanding of what is it going to cost individual cities throughout the state to actually do this inventory work too. And my understanding, as the Department of Health is going to come by, the governor is recommending $4 million. I don't know if that $4 million will actually complete the job of doing the inventory work. And so, Ms. Eschnauer, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Lee. For the record, my name is Tani Eschnauer, and I am the manager of the Water Policy Center in the Division of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for the opportunity today to provide some insight and information into lead and drinking water here in Minnesota. In a 2017 Clean Water Fund appropriation from the legislature to the Minnesota Department of Health, we were charged with investigating the causes and costs of lead in our drinking water and then identifying the solutions and quantifying the benefits. We teamed up with policy experts from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and then also applied economists from the Water Resource Center. You have been provided with a copy of this report, and now I'll give just a brief summary of the findings.
Sorry, Ms. Eschnauer, before you proceed, can your presenter put on the slideshow?
Sure.
It was on the
PowerPoint. Apologies, just one moment. Apologies, sorry about that.
Oh, you should continue, Ms. Eschnauer.
Okay, I thank you. I'll continue, Mr. Chair. So there's no safe level of lead in our drinking water. Lead is a potent toxin that impairs brain development in infants and children, and it causes other health problems as well. Community water systems have been addressing lead in through the lead and copper rule, which is part of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. They add chemicals to the water or change the chemistry of the drinking water so that the water forms a protective liner between the lead in pipes and plumbing and the water traveling through those pipes and plumbing to our home. I'll give Kristen just a minute to catch up here. We should be on the slide. There we go. Thank you. Previous slide, please. Thanks. Okay. So we have been addressing lead in drinking water all along through requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act, but Flint was a stark tragedy that reminds us that as long as the source, the lead, is there, there is a potential for our other safeguards to fail. As a reminder, usually there's no lead in the source waters that we use for our drinking water, the rivers, lakes, and groundwater from which we draw our drinking water. About half of the lead in drinking water comes from the lead service lines that connect our homes to the water main or from pipes, solder, and fixtures inside our homes. The ownership of these lead service lines varies from city to city. Sometimes the city owns the line from the water main under the street to the curb, and the homeowner owns from the curb to the meter in the home. In other cities, the homeowner owns it all. Next slide, please. Based on the age of housing stock and some other factors, we estimated that there are about 100,000 lead service lines in Minnesota. We won't have a more exact number until community water systems complete the lead service line inventory that is required by the recently revised lead and copper rule of the Safe Drinking Water Act, and the date for that is October of 2024. In 2019, we estimated that the cost of removing this 100,000 lead service lines would be between $0.2 billion and $0.4 billion. There's been substantial increases in these costs since that report, and now experts estimate that the total cost would be closer to half a billion. On the benefit side of the equation, the primary cause of these benefits is preventing the loss of IQ that results from consuming lead in drinking water. This prevention results in increases in expected lifetime earnings and productivity. So for every dollar we invest in removing lead service lines, there's at least $2 in benefits, The return on investment is twofold. Removing lead service lines clearly benefits Minnesota. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to my engineer colleague, Chad Colstead.
Mr. Colstead, welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee members, I'm Chad Colstead. Kristen, can you please go to the next slide? I'm Chad Colstead with the Minnesota Department of Health. I am the Infrastructure Program Coordinator for the Department of Health. And today I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the importance of lead service line inventories and asset management, a little bit of a summary of the governor's proposal. So as you know, we're looking at the service line. Kristen, can you please go back one quick slide? So just awareness for all members that we're looking at the service line is what we consider from the water main in the street to the meter in the house. So it's a buried service line, so it's complicated to know what's out there and how to identify it. Next slide, please. And really what the goal is to get the lead out, both throughout the state and throughout the nation. That's been the big push, get the lead out. Well, how do you get the lead out? First, you have to know where those lead service lines exist. And second, you know, need to know our replacement costs, you know, how much money to put towards it. And I should put a large R instead of a small R here now, because we're actually not talking about just the individual replacement costs, but what the replacement cost is going to be throughout the state. And on top of that, because there's such a desire to get the lead out across the nation, EPA has a new regulation requiring that lead service line inventories need to be completed by October of 2024, which is going to be a challenge for a lot of these municipalities and utilities because they lack the resources to be able to complete an accurate inventory. Next slide, please. And part of what the inventory is and the information that needs to be gathered, a lot of these small towns have a single operator. Even if they have multiple staff, they might not have the records available and things like that. But how you kind of start to gather an inventory is you're looking at your historic paper records, be it installation records, plumbing permits, plans and specs when they did installation. Some cities have what they consider tap cards. So that was kind of a record of a service installation. And then if you don't have those records, then you actually have to do visual inspections. So either get inside the home or actually dig a hole in the yard or in the street. Next slide, please. And then once you kind of gather that information, as you're gathering that information, you actually have to put that information somewhere. You know, a lot of these small towns don't have the technological expertise to do some of these things. So be it an Excel-based spreadsheet, some will have their engineers put the information into a GIS map. But most importantly is, as you're gathering lead service line inventory information, you should also be putting it into an asset management plan. So I always consider that lead service line inventories are a smaller part of a larger asset management plan. And that's kind of the general principle of this whole thing. Next slide, please. So what the governor's proposal is basically to create a grant program to fund, to provide assistance for lead service line inventories and asset management plan. It's a total of $3.75 million per year for 2 years to be passed on to approximately 750 water systems, and we're estimating it would cost about $10,000 per system. Some may not need any of it, some are going to need a lot more. Again, you know, lead service line inventories are just part of an overall asset management plan. So when it comes to funding, what Jeff kind of mentioned earlier, is we need to figure out what our needs are, both on lead service line inventory, but also our capital investment needs on drinking water throughout their system, not just the lead service lines. And that's why the asset management plan is valuable, because for these small cities to be able to know what their needs are, by doing an asset management plan, that can help them get on the path to funding to actually make improvements in their system. And by actually having a proper asset management plan, it actually allows them to set their rates accordingly so that they don't need to necessarily request grants in the future for future infrastructure upgrades. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Colstead. Well, thanks to all the presenters, actually. I would just like to start by talking about the sense of urgency that I feel around this. We have all of these homes where we know there's a lead risk. We've known it for a long time, and we've been doing things. We've been working on it, but as we go on and on, I'm feeling a sense of concern and pressure for the families who are affected, recognizing that it is a life-changing problem, that it's an equity issue in terms of who it affects most. And just want to share that all of my questions come from a perspective of thinking about the people who are affected and my anxiety on their well-being. So my first question is, and I hope you'll be patient with me, Chairlee, I just have a couple questions. My first question is about how much we're doing now. I wanted to wait to hear both presentations because I know we're doing things, but when I hear these plans, it sounds like we have to know everything before we do anything. So I'm curious how much we're doing now and how we'll be able to, how we could accelerate that now. What do we have now? What do we know now? We don't need to know everything before we can prioritize some projects. So how are we going to be phasing that? And thank you.
Mr. Costa.
Surely, Representative Ryer, that's a great question. So one of the things with the Drinking Water Revolving Fund is we're not requiring that they have a completed lead service line inventory. So we've kind of been encouraging water systems as they're doing water main replacement projects to apply for the Drinking Water Revolving Fund to get those lead service lines out. If they also wanted to do an individual project for individual service lines separate from water main project because they've know an area of town that might have additional or have a lot of lead service lines, they can also apply. So there's no requirement that they have to have a completed lead service line inventory done before they can apply for funding. So we have many systems now that are starting to apply that don't have complete lead service line inventories. But it is a good question. So,
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kolstad. My second question is about project planning. There's the three-legged stool of project management, quality, cost, and time. And this goes back to Chair Lee's question on a $4 million investment in inventory. I think I saw that that provides two staff and thinking about the scope of the work. I'm concerned that that isn't sufficient and that we would need to be looking at more based on the complexity and the understandable complexity of the work that needs to be done. And so I would ask for whoever would have the best opinion, is that in your professional opinion a realistic number, or would it be beneficial for us to be advocating for more? Because if we have until 2024 to get it done, we have two people. If it has done means done, quality is going to be the thing that takes the hit, and I know none of us want that.
Mr. Kolstad.
Yep, surely you're Representative Ryer. You're right. I mean, if it was just those two people working on the lead service line inventory, there would be nowhere near enough. The kind of intent of the proposal, I believe, is to actually create a program where systems can hire consultants or additional resources, and those two staff would actually be the ones kind of overseeing the program to provide those funds to the communities.
Representative Ryer, last one, and then we move on to the other members.
Thank you. Thank you for your grace on that. My last question is about the individual, the property owner's piece of it, and whether or not funding is also available within this program for them and not just the public part.
Mr. Kolstad.
Chair Lee, Representative Ryer. Yes, actually the way the program exists right now without any legislative changes is we can provide 50% grant to the private portion of the lead service line replacement. And then the remainder of the service line and would actually be eligible for a drinking water revolving fund loan. So the grant funding right now is directed specifically at the private portion of the lead service line replacement.
And Representative Ryer, Representative Jordan is on and has a bill to do the residential lead service line. Chair Hansen and then Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the beauty of zooming in from a coffee shop is I had people talking to me while we were listening to lead service lines. And I had a realtor that just mentioned about disclosure and that the accuracy of lead service line notification is fairly limited because often the seller will say I don't know. The realtor mentioned that likely 100 sales that he had been experienced with, the seller did not know if there were lead service lines. So my question, when the Department of Health is developing an inventory, are they looking at those sales records, or is that involved at all in determining the area? And I would note, you know, I represent older communities. It's not just small towns. It is old communities in the city as well that have these lead service lines. And the memory of those houses being put in 100 years ago is gone. So when there is an I don't know answer on sales, how does the Department of Health account for that when doing an inventory?
Mr. Kolstad.
Shirley, Representative Hansen, it is a good question. So, you know, disclosure information typically with the property. So we don't necessarily gather that. It's going to be on a city-by-city basis, I think, in a lot of cases. Those might be a source of records, but really it comes down, if they don't have those proper records, it really does require someone to get into the home to do an identification. Some of the cities have gone as far as to have like a website set up where their residents can take a picture and upload that picture into the city's database, and the water operator or one of their staff can actually look at the picture to determine if it's a lead service line or not. So there's a lot of new ideas coming out there. The other hope too is after these inventories are complete, we've been working with the University of Minnesota to develop a mapping tool where residents, well, once the cities upload their information into the tool, residents will actually physically be able to go into this tool, look up their physical address, and determine whether or not they have a lead service line.
Thank you, Mr. Kolstad. Chair Hansen, last follow-up.
It would seem to me that $4 million for the inventory is not enough if we have to have a better assessment than looking at data that says, I don't know. I like the suggestion about an app where people could take a photo of theirs and send it in. That's a lot of data, a lot of people. But if we go door to door, that's a lot of people as well. So, Shirley, I think we need a significant amount of money to be going towards the inventory as soon as possible.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Representative Erdahl and then Chair Freiberg. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is best for Ms. Eschenauer or Mr. Kolstad, but going back to my question earlier, or relating to an earlier question, if there are 100,000 lead service lines that are still in the state, what percent of our total lines is that?
Ms. Eschenauer or Mr. Kolstad, whoever.
Chair Lee, Representative Erdahl. Tanny, I'm not sure if you know the exact number of lead service line or service lines throughout the state. We can get that number for you, Representative.
Yeah.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Colson. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm just trying to get the handle on, we have these many lines, we're trying to remedy it. How many more lines are out there that may need this in the future? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions have been sort of covered. I mean, I agree with the comments of Representatives Erdahl, Ryer, and Hansen that this is probably a much bigger problem than $4 million can address. I think we've heard about that from the scope. So, I mean, I guess maybe if the either Ms. Eschenauer or the other testifier could speak just to how these will be prioritized. I mean, both in terms of the public portion and the private portion. You know, some communities may better be able to afford replacing their service lines. So, you know, it's an expensive proposition for residents in particular. So, you know, will there be like for the private portion, will there be income guidelines? Just a little more information on that, because I do think we need a greater investment, but even a greater investment that we'll be able to do probably won't be enough. So some method of prioritization, I think, will be really important here.
Mr. Kolstad.
Yeah, Shirley, Representative Freiberg. I just a clarifying statement, I guess, is, you know, the $4 million is for the inventory. Is this to actually inventory the service lines, to actually get the service lines removed from the ground? Is the numbers that Jeff Freeman previously mentioned at about $43 million a year for the next 5 years. As of right now, we don't have enough projects actually to use up all those funds. But as we do, yes, there might have to be a determination priority to assure that the funding is going to the right individuals.
Chair Freiberg, last follow-up.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. And so, you know, Mr. Kolstad, last question for you. So the $4 million that the Department of Health is proposing will address approximately 750 water systems in your presentation. How many water systems are there in the entire state? Does that 750 complete all water systems, or do we have more?
Shirley, we have approximately, Danny, I believe it's just under 1,000 community public water supplies. About 736 municipal public water supplies. The municipal public water supplies are really the ones that are targeted here. The community public water supplies don't have as much of a need, so it's kind of a balance. That's why you kind of use the number of 750 across the 10,000. So I think the 750 pretty well represents the systems that would have a need here.
Okay, and then I think the last comment for all before we move on to the bill, I think one other point that you had, Mr. Kolstad, in your presentation is about the cities having the lack of resources to complete this inventory, and I think that's what Chair Freiberg was getting to, where I don't know if, you know, my city, the city of Minneapolis, or the cities that represent Erdahl, or the cities that, you know, Chair Freiberg actually represent will have the capability and the ability, the financial resources to do this inventory work. And it will be good to know more of how that $4 million will be divvied up, possibly to help out these local municipalities. And I'm glad that for Representative Jordan's bill, House File 2650, we do have the mayor of Pipestone here too. And Mr. Mayor, if you could shed some light on that, you know, once you do your presentation, that would be great. So next on the agenda, House File 2650, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good morning, members of the committee. I'm excited to present House File 2650, a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. Members, this is fundamentally a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead. And if there's one takeaway I want all of us to walk away from today, it is that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. Lead service lines are one of the largest sources of lead in Minnesota's drinking water. Often lead service lines are both publicly and privately owned, as we've been discussing, and we must replace parts simultaneously to avoid increasing lead concentration in drinking water. And this is a challenge for committee, state, and communities, as we've been talking about. Lead exposure through drinking water is a statewide issue. Lead service lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, urban, suburban, and rural. Lead exposure through service lines is most common in lower income communities, and many cities and townships do not have a comprehensive map of lead lines. House File 2650 creates a grant program to fund the removal of all lead service lines in Minnesota. Cities may use these grants to identify and map their existing lead lines, remove and replace lead lines, and maximize federal funding for lead line replacement. Priority is given to removal projects in census tracts with concentrated poverty or located in designated opportunity zones. Priority is also given contractors.
More Aaron, Jordan, your connection is not so good, so you might want to turn off your video and try again.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yep, please proceed.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. Did you hear what I was talking about, prevailing wage?
No, we didn't get that.
Okay. So my bill says that priority must be given low-income communities and designated opportunity zones, and it also must prioritize contractors who pay the prevailing wage rate, which is also included in state law under PFA and with the federal bipartisan infrastructure bill. I'm still working on this bill to maximize federal funding and ensure this meets the needs of Minnesota cities, townships, workers, and water drinkers. PA is still working on guidelines for distributing infrastructure money related to lead service lines, and this bill will evolve as we have more information. And as Director Freeman said, we're expecting further guidance later today. I'm sure none of us want to leave federal funding on the table to improve the health and well-being of our constituents. I'm currently working with the Minnesota Department of Health, PFA, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, union members, and clean water advocates, and would welcome all of your help as well. Above all, House File 2650 seeks to minimize Minnesotans' exposure to lead in our drinking water. Not only will this bill improve our quality of life, but a report by the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota in 2019 found that for every dollar spent on addressing lead in our drinking water, we would see at least $2 return in benefits from better health outcomes. That same report is where the $300 million estimate has come from, but we are still awaiting guidance on final cost, as I stated earlier. That number will change. Members, this is the same report you received an overview of from Ms. Eschnauer, and it is worth reading in its entirety, but policy recommendations are at the end. Remember, members, no amount of exposure to lead is safe, and this bill addresses the most common source of lead contact in Minnesota. Thank you for prioritizing lead removal this morning, and I'd like to turn it over to testimony from the community members.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mayor. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Lee. My name is Myron Coots. I'm the mayor of Pipestone, Minnesota, which is, if you're not familiar with Pipestone, we're in the southwest part of the state. What I would like to cover very quickly is a little bit of history of how all these communities in outstate Minnesota, especially southwest Minnesota, you know, were established in the 1870s, 1880s, and our greatest growth in the number of housing units and so forth have been prior to World War II. And which really lends kind of the topic of conversation to have, what records do we have on these particular buildings? What building permits were put in place at that time? I can say from experience, the data that we have on that is very spotty. Best, the best information we have is where we've actually have completed infrastructure upgrades in those areas. Now, in Pipestone, I can relate to this, is that we have about a 16 block by 10 block area where most of these lead water service lines will be located. With that, we estimate somewhere between 125 and 150 lead lines in that area. The only way that we can really accurately determine where these lines are at is going into the homes or to do exploratory digging. One of the issues that we have in listening to the conversations today is that this core part of town, this 160 square block area, is where our workforce lives. It's affordable housing, or more affordable housing, market rate, or it's rental property. And the income of the people living in that area is economically stressed. So it becomes a real problem for homeowners to actually pay for this. And I'm going to include rental property also, because if a landlord has to incur costs to upgrade like a water service line, they're going to pass it on to the renter regardless to recoup their costs. We're estimating of the 125 to 150 lines that are in that area, approximately $3,000 per service line to replace. And again, majority of the homeowners are in an economically stressed area, so it's going to be difficult for them to essentially pay for this on a market basis. One of the things that we heard today, and which is very true for PFA, when we have a project, we will do a complete inventory of water service lines, also the clay tile, sanitary sewer lines, which allow groundwater to penetrate into our sanitary sewer system, and we replace all that. MPCA has been very good on the clay lines for the sanitary sewer. The PFA has been very good, and we've used them a number of times on a project basis. What concerns me, what I've heard today, is that, what concerns me, we got this 160 square block area. We're going to do six square blocks next year on infrastructure upgrade, or we're hoping to. So we're going to have to go back into areas where we don't have projects to replace these lines. And that is a little confusing. And hopefully the bills will cover how that would be reimbursed to the homeowner or to the community. That's kind of a real short presentation of where we're at, Chairman Lee. I would gladly answer any questions that any of the members would have.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Alacron, I apologize if I mistakenly pronounced your name. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcelo Alarcon, and I'm a business agent for La Una Local 563. We represent more than 10,000 skilled construction general laborers who build and maintain roadways, bridges, and the basic utilities that our communities count on. I am here today to strongly support House File 2650, which calls for eliminating all lead service lines in our state by 2032. And provides that the direct grant funding necessary to ensure that the cities replace lead line services, lines that threaten the health and safety of throughout the entire state of Minnesota. I also support this proposal because it will launch and maintain thousands of high quality family sustaining prevailing wage jobs for tradesmen and women throughout the state of Minnesota. I joined the labor union when I was 20 years old. Soon after that, landed a job with Carl Bolander and Son as a bottom man on a sewer and water crew. The Labor's Training Center equipped me with OSHA safety knowledge, including proper excavation and confined space safety and awareness of all the hazards associated with handling lead as a toxic material. And beyond working water and sewer, I worked my way up to become a labor foreman and had helped build major projects all over the state for the last 20 years. I'm extremely proud of being able to put food on the table and provide a nice home for my family. Our registered apprenticeship programs, critical efforts that bring women, people of color, and veterans into life-changing careers in the trades. Mr. Chair, I want to thank Representative Jordan for bringing forward this proposal, and I strongly encourage members of this committee to support House File 2650 because it will make Minnesota safer, make our communities healthier, and create family-supporting construction careers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Alacon. Members, do we have any questions for Representative Jordan or her testifiers? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am on the freeway. Hopefully the wind noise is not overriding my voice. I have a couple questions for the bill author, and Mr. Chair, and the first question is the bill author had stated that her bill will be prioritized in opportunity zones and those areas of higher concentration of poverty. Could the bill author please tell us just a handful of what some of those areas would be by city?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill says census tracts with 60% or more of concentrated poverty, and an opportunity zone is a federal designation, and the governor of the state nominates an area or a neighborhood or a city to the federal government to be declared an opportunity zone. I believe the only one in many, I'm not familiar with where they all are across the state, but there are numerous ones. One opportunity zone would be North Minneapolis, for example. But there are, of course, census tracts with 60% or more of concentrated poverty in many parts of the state.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. So the next question is what is the rationale for targeting these areas when my understanding from the bill of his testimony or remarks was that no amount of lead is safe for any person? What is the rationale for prioritizing these areas or prioritizing anybody, to be honest?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rationale is that these are areas that have more, these are areas that tend to have more lead. And they also tend, low-income areas tend to also have more adverse effects from lead exposure from lead in other areas. The other purpose of this is because the guidance from the federal government also says that economic justice and environmental justice areas need to be prioritized. And I think it's important to remember that we're not targeting every single pipe in the state of Minnesota. We're targeting every single lead service line. And these are also the older communities, lower income communities tend to have more lead service lines.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just finish with a couple of remarks here then. Well, I believe that every life matters. All lives matter. And I believe that I do not subscribe to any theory that lower income has a greater adverse impact from lead exposure. Regardless of your income level, you're going to have an adverse impact to lead. And so while I'm certainly in favor of doing everything we can, as a real estate agent myself, I think Representative Hansen had referred to a real estate agent who had overheard the conversation in the previous bill. As a real estate agent myself, I actually own a house that's pre-1978 before lead was prohibited. And so I'm just baffled at trying to target people based on income and somehow thinking that they are more important than everybody else. I think that we should not be discriminating against any communities. I represent communities that have houses that were built in the 1800s. And I don't think there's a concentrated area of poverty in my community. But nevertheless, there's no connection or correlation with age of home, age of community, concentration of poverty, income level, and adverse impacts from lead exposure. So, Mr. Chair, we need to just do away with the discrimination here, and we need to do everything we can for a true One Minnesota and keep everybody safe. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero. I agree that no one in your community should have exposure to lead. I do know that there are many connections between income level and exposure to lead, and it's a fact, it's true, and we need to make priorities somewhere. And I think it's appropriate to make priorities based on income level, in large part due to the fact that we also need to replace both the publicly and privately held portion of the line. And people who have a higher income level are much better suited and able to replace the privately held portion of the line than low-income communities. I think the prioritization is very important. Representative Breyer talked quite a bit about that. So did Mayor Coates. And I think it's something that needs to stay in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for coming by. And I appreciate your comment about all the discussion today, knowing that, you know, we are having some regulations coming in at the federal level, and we also are receiving federal funding. I think that's why it's important for us to have this public discussion so that cities and towns throughout the entire state, you know, are receiving this information so that we could best plan for the future. And so I really appreciate you coming by today. Next up on the agenda is House File 3003, Representative Acom. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for the opportunity for an informational hearing on House File 3003. This bill comes out of a stakeholder process from the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy. The subcommittee is made up of members of both parties and both bodies of our legislature and reviews water policy issues that affect Minnesota and in turn proposes legislation. House File 3003 is one of those bills. As we have heard several times today, there is no safe level of lead, and while anyone may face health impacts when exposed to lead at elevated levels, children are the most vulnerable due to their developing brains and bodies. As Ms. Eichenauer mentioned, Minnesota requires that schools test lead, at least I think she did in a former or a previous testimony, but I think it's been talked about that schools test every 5 years, but there's no requirement for water testing at childcare facilities. As we have heard, there are some grant funds that allow for testing in childcare centers, but not for remediation. Since childcare facilities are usually private businesses, owners may be reluctant to do testing without funds to address the lead problems that they may find. So grants for remediation could help fix this issue. House File 3003 has two parts. The first is to provide funding for the Department of Health to focus testing on for lead in private wells, daycare facilities, and rental properties, and to remediate where found. And the second part of the bill is to provide funding to improve the lead inventory line, or the lead service inventory that we've heard so much about today. That information is helpful for people as they can make informed decisions when purchasing or renting homes. And I do have a testifier today. I believe Ms. Eschnauer was listed as a testifier, though I think she was just here to present testimony prior to the conversation on the bill. But Mr. Broberg, I believe, is here to testify.
Thank you, Representative Acorn. Mr. Broberg, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Broberg. I'm a licensed professional geologist and one of the directors of the Minnesota Well Owners Organization. And we're in support of this bill because of the fact that it provides testing and knowledge to people. We've been holding water testing clinics across the state of Minnesota with over 1,000 participants being screened for nitrates and chlorides over the last 9 months. And one of the most frequently asked questions is about lead. We can't just screen for lead. It needs a valid certified laboratory test for the lead. And what we found is that testing is power. Testing is knowledge, and knowledge is power. People understand once they have the tests, and it motivates people throughout the community to have those tests and discuss them. This is a great opportunity to provide that in schools, daycares, and private wells. Where sometimes the lead issues are a little more complicated due to lead pipes and appliances, but it puts everybody on an even keel about the concerns for lead, and it's throughout the state of Minnesota, and it really advances the public health by allowing and promoting the testing and having the ability to come up with mitigation that's affordable and reasonable for private well owners. So I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Broberg. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the bill author, Representative Acum. Representative Acum, if I'm reading the bill text correctly, in Section 2, it looks like there's a blank appropriation that would be made to the state auditor. And I was just wondering, Mr. Chair, if the bill author could explain, why there's an appropriation going to the state auditor and why the state auditor's office would be the appropriate place for this money to go.
Representative Acorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen. The tool, so there's the inventory, which is this. It's in the bill is talked about as the infrastructure transparency tool is the inventory that's been talked about today. And so that is filed through it's worked through the University of Minnesota, the Department of Health, and the State Auditor's Office.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it just seems, if we're thinking about this from a long-term perspective, my observation would be this just seems like a very odd thing for the state auditor's office to be kind of managing on a go-forward basis. And so the feedback that I would have is, looking at perhaps another agency of government that would be a more appropriate place to be thinking about, lead pipes and the impact that it has on drinking water going forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Acum, for the conversation on that aspect of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Acum, any closing comments?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity for the informational hearing today and the focus on lead in committee.
Thank you, Representative Acum, and your testifier for coming by. Next up, we'll move to Chair Sundin, House File 329. Chair Sundin, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and committee. I'm here today presenting House File 3239 for the Northern Lights Academy Special Education Cooperative and the Northland Learning Center Special Education Program. The Northern Lights Academy, headquartered in Cloquet, my district, serves communities from McGregor, Moose Lake, Willow River, all the way north to Hermantown, Two Harbors, and Silver Bay in Representative Eklund's district. The Northland Learning Center in Virginia is in Representative Listengard's district. It serves students on the Iron Range all the way up to International Falls and over to Grand Marais in Cook County. The collaborative school districts serve students with a wide range of severe special needs, including autism, emotional behavior disorders, cognitive disabilities, and more. These two districts provide true, continued cooperation among area schools across northern Minnesota. To flesh out some of the details of their program and their ask, I have with me today Dina Hagen, Director of Special Education from the Northern Lights Academy, and Ryan Juretich, Executive Director of the Northland Learning Center.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. Ms. Hagen, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Actually, Brian Juretich is going to plan to go next.
Mr. Juretich, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members, for having us this morning. Also, thank you to Representative Sundin for bringing the bill forward. My name is Brian Juretich. I'm the Executive Director at the Northland Learning Center, located in Virginia, Minnesota. Director Hagen and I looked at how do we best bring our information forward by answering some questions that we would anticipate committee members having. And so that's what our goal today was, to share some of the answers to our questions. And certainly at the end, we'd be open to more questions. As Representative Sundin did say, is that we are programs that offer special education and alternative services to students across northeastern Minnesota, covering quite a large part of our state. If you think about the state of Minnesota and look at the whole Arrowhead region, that's pretty much our coverage area. We are school districts that are obligated to provide this continuum of special education services to students. And so that's what our programs are here for, is to provide those services to our students with the highest behavioral and mental health needs. Before our programs were in place, a lot of our students had very limited options as far as programming goes for addressing their high needs. Many times due to safety, they were often homebound or placed in learning situations where they were home, and then we were providing services within that home. We are both a very cooperative models of school districts coming together to share resources. So our long-term commitment is to provide those quality services that we're obligated to provide to all of our students with special needs. We have explored many different options in both of our programs of looking at existing buildings and spaces to try to provide that support. But there is a very limited or no availability to some of these spaces in our areas of the state, which is much of a rural area. We do believe that the cooperative model is a much more efficient use of our spaces and resources and coming together to help share those resources together. We're keeping our services centrally located so that all of our member districts can access them, and that it really adds value to our cooperatives, but also to our communities that have the supports and needs. This is where I'll pass it back over to Director Hagen.
Yes, good morning, Chair Lee, Vice Chair Murphy, and members. My name is Dina Hagen. I'm the Director of Special Education for the Northern Lights Academy Cooperative. And I'm going to next answer the question of why the state should partner with us. As mentioned, students at our schools have very severe disabilities and mental health needs. They can't attend regular schools due to safety. And we are familiar with the fact that mental health and behavioral support is really a top priority in our state of Minnesota. And we need help from the state to educate all Minnesota students, especially those with the highest needs. And our districts just cannot do it alone. Rural Minnesota districts cannot meet the needs like our metro districts can. We have much smaller tax bases in our communities, and really we've been trying for years to find a solution for our facility needs up in northeastern Minnesota, and we haven't been able to get it done. State help would really help our taxpayers up in this area of the state, save tax dollars. And without the support from the state, we cannot do these projects. We've tried every other way. Brian?
Thank you. The next question we were trying to answer was, why can't our districts fund this? It's challenging for all of our school districts to come together. As you can imagine, in Director Hagen's area, she has 12 school districts, and I have 9 school districts that I'm working with. To come to common agreement on a funding plan and source is difficult when you have many districts that are very strapped for funds to begin with. When we've been trying for years to find these different solutions, and funding always seems to be that barrier to making these projects move forward. Right now, our member districts only have their regular lease levy authorities to rely on for some of this funding, or their general education funds that are available for all students as options to pay for the projects. Several of our districts are maxed out on their current levy authorities, which leaves them only to their general funds, which then straps the district for any of that cash.
Yeah. I just want to share with you a couple of ways that other similar projects to ours have been funded across other parts of the state. Districts in central Minnesota have access to large $1 million grants from companies like Sourcewell. We don't have access to things like that. And as we have mentioned about the lease levy authority, Metro Intermediate districts also have an additional $65 per pupil for projects like this that co-ops do not get access to in current statute. And so we really have a disadvantage. Director Juretich.
Thank you. So just to share a little bit more about the Northland Learning Center and some specifics there. I've been a part of the Northland Learning Center for over 20 years. And in that time, I have worked with thousands of students that have come through our doors seeking that high behavior and mental health support to address their needs. I definitely have seen the impact on our students. Many times I run into them within our community setting, and you can see that light in their eyes. You can see how they have become productive members of our community. So just stressing the importance of these programs. Research does show that environment influences behavior and mood, and with the right fitting and designed environment, we can have more of that positive impact on our students. Thank you, Dina.
Yes, and I just want to take a few more seconds to talk a little bit more individually about the Northern Lights Academy and Cloquet, because our programs have really changed student lives in the last 5 years. I have a quick example of a student that was in our program for 3 years. Prior to that, they were only able to learn at home for safety, and came to our program and now is a functioning member of a typical high school and ready to go on for life. Our kids don't have any playground. We don't have any green space. We can't serve everybody. We're out of space. We're using the broom closet spaces in what we can find. And $6 million would really help us to build a school that we need, the quality education for kids that need it the most. So we're really asking you to please help us fund our school projects, because we can't think of a more important way to spend money than to invest in kids. You're welcome to come and tour any of our spaces anytime. And thank you so much to Representative Sundin for authoring our bill. And thanks to the committee for hearing us today.
Thank you, Ms. Hagen and Mr. Juretich. Member, any questions for Chair Sundigan and his testifiers? Seeing none, Chair Sundigan, quick closing comments.
Thank you for your time and consideration. This is desperately needed in rural Minnesota, and I thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Sundigan. Next up, we have Representative Bierman, House File 3348. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for hearing House File 3348. This is a bill that provides funding for an inclusive and accessible playground in the city of Apple Valley.
Start, or I'll break your fucking legs.
The city is working in partnership with a coalition that has a goal of partnering with cities across the state to support the construction of inclusive and accessible playgrounds. Coalition partners include the ARC Minnesota, Autism Society of Minnesota, Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, Minnesota Autistic Alliance, Minnesota Courts Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and Multicultural Autism Action Network. So I'm going to turn the presentation over now to Mr. Eric Carlson, representing the City of Apple Valley, and Ms. Kelly Causal, a resident of Apple Valley, please.
Mr. Carlson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Eric Carlson. I'm the Parks and Recreation Director for the City of Apple Valley, and I'm going to share my screen here. Can you see that okay?
We see both of your slides, so I don't know if that's what you're intending for.
Let's see here. One quick second, I'll get it straightened out here. Oh, I got it. All right.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Again, Eric Carlson, City of Apple Valley Parks and Recreation Director. You know, the mission of the City of Apple Valley is as we pledge and promote and to enhance the health, safety, and general well-being of our citizens and all that visit. And we believe that having an inclusive playground in our community will help meet our goals and help support our keys to success, which are service, a great place to live. We want a safe community. We want to be able to make sure that we have parks for everyone in our community to experience so that they can be healthy and active. We want to make sure that what we provide is accessible, and we want to build a community for a lifetime. So what an inclusive playground is it encourages social play through sensory-rich experiences for people of all abilities and disabilities. It also helps users develop physically, socially, emotionally through positive play interactions. We are proposing to build an inclusive playground at Redwood Park, which is located within the City of Apple Valley. And on the screen, you see a draft master plan for the park. The park is a 12-acre park. It would include an inclusive playground, a splash pad, some courts, a picnic shelter, and appropriate parking for those that visit the park. The Redwood Park Inclusive Playground is a regional location. It's located on County Road 42 with close proximity to Interstate 35E and 35W. The investment the city would need to make for an inclusive playground in our city is $800,000. So we are requesting $400,000 of state bonding proceeds, and the City of Apple Valley would match the other $400,000. Our project is planned for 2024. Really, an inclusive playground meets the needs of all individuals, ages 2 to senior citizens. It's designed to meet the needs of no matter what a person's ability or disability may be. It provides a safe haven for people with disabilities, and it allows families to play together and sometimes for the first time if you haven't been able to experience play with your children if they happen to have a disability. It makes available some events and activities that help people with auditory and sensory issues. It offers a variety of challenge levels and incorporates active and quiet spaces for all people. And it also provides for cooperative and independent play opportunities. So I'm going to turn it over to our resident that has a special needs child, and her name is Kelly Causal.
Ms. Causal, please identify yourself and proceed. Representative Bierman, is Ms. Causal on?
I did see her. There she is.
Okay, sorry. Good morning, Chairman Lee and committee members. My name is Kelly Causal, and I'm a parent of an autistic child and resident of Apple Valley. We know the conversation around inclusive and accessible playgrounds is not a new one. individuals with disabilities, their families, and communities have been talking about the need for inclusive and accessible playgrounds for years. I am excited to see more and more communities understanding the need to think about inclusivity, and the work is far from done. Recent events have shined a spotlight on the fact that when we think about inclusivity and accessibility, we need to think about physical barriers to participation as well as those faced by children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Parks that are built without fencing or close to busy streets or watered hazards are not safe for all kids. We need to broaden the conversation about inclusivity and accessibility to make sure all of our kids have safe places to play. My personal experience with accessible playgrounds is worry about elopement, worrying about busy streets, worrying about lack of fencing, worrying about water hazards. Was going to the playground a stressful experience for my family? Did going to playgrounds feel like it was a different experience for you than it was for the families of children without disabilities? Just this past summer, a child lost her life at a playground that was designed to be an accessible playground, but there was no fence around the holding pond nearby. This heartbreaking tragedy has caused every family of a child with disability to reconsider what it means to keep their child safe. I am grateful for the City of Apple Valley and committed to getting it right, and I proudly support Bill HF3348. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cazzo.
Representative Hewitt.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this bill forward. As Representative Bierman knows, our district is very in need of this. We have the third highest cross subsidy with our schools, and I just recently learned that many of the Gillette Children's Hospital patients with special needs also live in our district, and so we have a definitely underserved population here, and this is a great equity project. So thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Kelly, again. Take care.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Bierman, seeing no other questions, quick closing comments.
I just want to thank the committee. Just ask again to please support this effort to build inclusive communities, and not only for Apple Valley, but for future bills you'll be seeing in committee on this topic. And the need is great throughout the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Next up, we have Representative Franson, House File 3422. Thank you for being patient and happy belated birthday.
Thank you, Chair. So we have before us an exciting bill brought to us by the City of Parker's Prairie for a Veterans Memorial Park. And due to time, I am just going to transfer my comments over to the testifiers. We have Mr. Tony Woodworth and Mr. Jim Arvidson, both of Parker's Prairie.
Mr. Woodworth or Mr. Arvidson, whichever first, please identify yourself and proceed.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mary and Chairman Lee, for allowing us to explain what we want to do in Parker's Prairie. It's a great day. It's a great day for our community of Parker's Prairie, and of course, it's also a great day for all of our veterans who we want to honor. We have plans for a park, and we would like to explain that a little bit more today. The park itself will be located right along Highway 29, which is on the south side of Parker's Prairie. For those of you not familiar with Highway 29, it comes up out of Alexandria into Parker's Prairie. The park will be right alongside Highway 29, and it's a beautiful area. We have a gently sloping slope that we will build the park into, and will be a great, great park. For many years, there has been a need to recognize and honor all of our veterans and men and women who have served our country. This will not only do that, but will also highlight the pride in our community, which I may add, we are a very proud community and have done some great things here in central Minnesota. Tony is with us today. He has been very instrumental in helping to bring the idea of a park forward and the design, and he's going to give us some details on what that park will be.
Mr. Woodworth, please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Tony Woodworth. I am part of the Veterans Memorial Committee here in Parker's Prairie.
I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us today. What we're looking at is about a 1,250 square foot triangular memorial park, primarily made of concrete and granite structures. The reason we've done with the granite structures, we've kind of made it maintenance free as much as possible, so no per se endowment fund is needed to keep this the upkeep on the park as low as possible, which again added to the cost a little bit to make this happen. Again, here in Parker's Prairie, our local communities have been hit pretty hard with COVID over the last couple of years, with a number of businesses either closing up or just no longer around. So we have a limited, a town of 1,100 population, we have a limited amount of money that we can get for this. We've paired with West Central Initiative to help us with our fundraising. They're just a nonprofit a fundraising corporation. Again, this overlooks the Lake Adley as you come into the south of town. We've also have a number of American Legion members on our committee as well who have put their input into this. Yeah, we're asking for any help that we can get from the from this committee to make this happen.
I would like to add that besides the community of 1,100 people here, this is something that will benefit the entire region, and especially all the great veterans that we are all so proud of. This park has the support and promotion of all our different Lions clubs, Legion Club, Sportsman's Club, etc., as well as all the people in the entire community.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Identify yourself.
Yeah, Jim Arvidson.
Thank you. Chair Murphy. Chair Murphy, you're on mute right now.
Could you tell what the total cost of the project is?
Mr. Arvidson and Mr. Woodworth.
It is estimated at $142,000, but probably will add to that as costs go up. So we're probably looking at $150,000 to $160,000.
Chair Murphy.
And what's the local match?
Mr. Woodworth or Mr. Arvidson?
Tony, you want
to? Yeah, so the match, we don't have per se a match, but we're looking at local businesses, local sportsmen's clubs that have already contributed. We've only been at this for about 5 months, so we're about maybe a quarter away there to where we need to be for the 142. Again, as Mr. Arvidson has stated, prices keep going up as the days go by, so that may extend. But as far as a total match from anybody, it's all a donation per se to get this funded.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woodworth. Seeing no other question, Representative Franson, any closing comments?
I just want to thank the committee for indulging our Parker's Prairie and House File 3422 before you. Representative Lee, thank you for the time. And to Mr. Woodworth and Mr. Arvidson, it's really a blessing to see you over Zoom and hope to see you in person real soon. So thanks for taking time out of your day today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franson. And so, members, we do have one more bill left on the calendar, but in the interest of time and to respect Representative Olson and her testifier, we will bring them back next week. That will be House File 3169. And, members, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 8th. On the agenda will be several transportation and active transportation-related bills, which will be heard on an informational basis only. This meeting is adjourned.